She has a very lovely accent.
When I first started hearing Carol, I was combining Cher and Carol. Carol Cher at the meetings. I just was instantly drawn to her. She's sweet, warm, funny, so caring. I love it because we started gratitude texting together, and I look forward to her morning gratitudes. And whenever I'm feeling kind of out of sorts after a meeting, she makes me laugh. She always makes me laugh and brings me back. And so I can't wait to hear you share. And come on up, Carol. Yay.
Hi, I'm Carol. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hey, Carol.
Is this loud enough?
Yes.
When I was a kid, my dad said I had a voice like a foghorn. But one of my teachers said I had a voice that carries. So I'll try and speak loudly so you can all hear me. My sobriety date is January 1st, 1985. And for that, I am so grateful. This is where I got sober. I was here every day, sometimes twice and three times a day back in the beginning. This was my haven. Sometimes I go home and I get like the EBGBs, I get squirrely, and I come back to Club 12 and there was always somebody here to talk me through whatever I was going through. Thank you, Connie, for asking me to speak. We do gratitudes each day, and when she asked me to do that, it was such a wonderful thing because I introduce myself always as a grateful alcoholic, and that's to remind myself. But that made me really, every day, look at what I'm grateful for. And I get a few other texts from other gals, too. And it has really made a difference in my life. I'm going to start off with a third-step prayer. And then I'll share my story. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, the victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. Amen. Obviously, I wasn't born here. I was born and raised in England in a little town called Chard, which is in the West Country, kind of between Bristol and Bath, near the coast. I am the oldest of four. I have a brother and two sisters younger than me. And I was going to say bossiness, but more like fixing things and making things right, or trying to make things right in the family, came naturally to me. I was 5.5 years old when my brother was born, so I was an only child. For 5.5 years. And when I first came in here, you know, I started looking for that missing link. What was it that set me off on this path of alcoholism? Maybe something happened to me. But I realized after I'd been sober for a while, I was an only child for 5.5 years. And then my brother and sister were born within a year and a half. And I was okay with it, but my parents didn't handle it very well. My dad was controlling, angry a lot, a workaholic because he was so afraid of being poor. He was one of 10, and when they grew up, they were really poor. He had a job before and after school from the time he was about 9 or 10. You know, my mother also was at this time stuck out in the country with no car and not able to go anywhere. And she became depressed, and difficulties started happening between the marriage. And I remember, you know, when I was growing up, there was just this atmosphere in the house most of the time. That would disappear on a Christmas Eve as my dad would come home jolly and happy, and it would last through Christmas Eve, and like maybe halfway through Christmas morning, and then something would happen. Either us kids would be too loud, or my brother would do something, and my dad would fly into a rage. And you know, we sort of tiptoed around a lot. Life was unpredictable, and that was kind of hard to deal with. But the other thing that came around this time, when I was 7, I met my best friend Kim, and I hadn't thought about money or clothes or what our house was like. I mean, it was always neat and tidy, but it was small, and you know, my dad was kind of miserly and didn't give my mum much money, and so we didn't have a lot of stuff. But Kim lived in this beautiful house, and she had beautiful clothes, and she had this huge bedroom. And one Christmas, I think I was 8, I had a desk for Christmas. That's what I asked for. I wasn't into dolls. I wanted a little desk and a lot of books and pens and stuff like that. I loved that little desk till I went over to Kim's house. And her dad had built her a desk that fit in this alcove window. It was huge, had drawers down the side and little cupboards up here. And so from that time, discontent set into me. That is definitely something that, you know, stayed with me until I got into the program. But what I was most jealous of was her dad. He was so kind, loving. He played with her. You know, I remember him coming down the stairs one time when we were sitting on the stairs, and he hugged and kissed Kim, and he kissed me on the head. And, I mean, that to most kids would be nothing. But to me, my dad, I never had to worry that anything, you know, happened untoward with my dad, because he never touched me. He never hugged me. He never touched me. And didn't talk to me very much either, unless I was getting told off. So another thing that happened that really started this resentment growing toward my dad was when I was 11. In England, back in the 50s and 60s, you took an exam when you were 11. And if you passed it, you went to an all-girls school or a boys' school. It was a really good education, free. Well, I passed this exam. I never expected to. And I thought, well, this is the thing that's going to get my dad's attention. He's going to be so proud of me. So I listened outside the door while he was eating his dinner and my mom told him. And I did not get the result I thought I was going to get. He didn't even answer when she told him about me, you know, passing this exam, going to this special school. So she told him again, and he said, I really don't care where she goes to school, but you're going to have to pay for her uniform out of your housekeeping money. And that's how I remember it. I do want to say right here that because of this wonderful program, my dad and I were reconciled. And that's because of the steps and realizing, understanding other people and why he was the way he was. But that's later in my story. So I was a pretty good kid. I was a pretty good student. But I had such, you know, low self-esteem. Like we all say, I didn't fit in. I didn't fit in with those girls. A lot of those girls in the school came from wealthy families. And the headmistress of that, it's a smallish school, that headmistress of that school really paid attention to the girls of the wealthy families. Any girls who came from just a regular family like me, we were kind of just not cast aside, but not noticed. And time goes on. I do quite well in school. I didn't drink. Until I was 17 and a half. That's when I had my first drink. And I went to a Christmas dance with my ex. We'd been dating for about 6 months. I had had a sip of Bacardi and Coke when I was 16. I thought it was awful. I would always drink fruit juice. Never crossed my mind that I would like alcohol. By the way, my dad's not an alcoholic. He was a rageaholic. My mom's not. One of my granddads may have been, but it seems to have only hit me. It must have been way back, you know, this dream. Anyhow, that first spring, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I felt it immediately. It changed the way I felt. I suddenly felt like I fit in. I wasn't self-conscious. I was funny. When I drank, I was funny. And before that, I wasn't. I was mysterious. And so I think I had 3, maybe 4 drinks that night. And it was wonderful. I can't remember all what happened, but I wasn't falling down drunk or anything like that. But I threw up, and I can't remember when that was. I think it was when I got home, and the next morning was Christmas. Wasn't Christmas Day, but I remember I was pretty sick the next day. But I just couldn't wait to do it again. And seeing it was close to Christmas, I got to drink again over Christmas. And I never just wanted to have one. You know, I always wanted that feeling, that buzz, that, you know, I love in the big book where it says we lit up, because I lit up, and I was suddenly alive. I didn't drink a lot or very often for a few years. The whole time my ex and I were dating, we dated for 3 years. But on special occasions like Christmas, birthdays, if we went on vacation, then I would drink. It just went along with a special occasion. We were going out more, so I was drinking more. And I didn't drink at home yet, but this is dating me. In 1977, I was 24. And I had started, this discontent now was coming out in my marriage. We have been married for 4 years. And, you know, I just felt, you know, like discontent. And the thing with me was that I always wanted to be someone else, doing something else, somewhere else, and now with someone else. And although I didn't, you know, I didn't have any affairs at that time, I had affairs of the heart, and that affected our marriage. Well, I remember this night, and maybe that's, I just remember, it's like a pivotal moment in my drinking. My ex was out doing something, and so I was home alone, and I grabbed a bottle of vermouth and an ice bucket full of ice, and I sat down next to the radiator. It was in the winter, in February, and I plowed through that bottle, and a thought was firmly planted in my mind from then on. When I'm down in the dumps, I need a drink. And so, consequently, I was down in the dumps more often. And that's when I started drinking at home. It wasn't every night to start with, but it was the progression that usually happens with us. And it went from drinking every weekend, Friday night, Saturday and Sunday, to me bringing home bottles a couple times a week. And, you know, my ex used to say, "What are we going through so many bottles of booze?" And so then I started hiding them, sneaking them in. I remember I brought a bottle, I think it was probably gin and vodka, I don't know. But I had a couple bottles in a bag down by my desk. And by the way, I was a very good worker up until this time. I had been a legal secretary, and now I was working as a personal secretary in an aircraft company. And my boss walked behind me, I don't know why, but he walked behind me, tripped over the bottles. But he never even realized, I asked him this later on, he never realized that those were bottles. But I remember falling asleep on my typewriter, that dates me too, quite often, because I'd go out at lunchtime and maybe have a couple of, you know, beers or lagers, only drank small ones then at lunchtime. But I would bring the booze back and then I'd have a few at work. I had a couple of really bad wrecks. The first one, I was driving home, and this is what happened to me a lot. I would go out, get drunk, and I would just pass out, fall asleep. So I fell asleep at the wheel, and I plowed into a car showroom window. The sound of the breaking glass woke me up with a jolt, and I quickly backed up, sped away from the scene, thinking I hadn't been seen. I didn't have my lights on, and I'm halfway home, and I'm thinking, what the hell's the matter? I can't see anything. And, you know, that by the way, I was kind of sober now because of that. But I had my lights off halfway home. Well, I thought I got away with it, but there was a policeman in our door the next day. So they never took away my license. I had to go to court, and I had to pay some costs, and I made a big amends to the guy who owned the showroom. The next big one I had was just before I came to the States. My ex was already here, and same, I went out, I got drunk, I fell asleep coming home down these country roads, and I fell asleep and drove into a cemetery wall. And this was a very high wall. I was in this old car that I called my Racing Onion. If any of you know old English cars, it was an A40. And it had a huge steering wheel. So I didn't go through the windshield because this huge steering wheel pinned me in. I think if I'd gone through the windshield, I wouldn't be here today because, I mean, it was right there. My car looked like an accordion. And all my wheels, all my tires were in shreds. And I told everybody, my family, my ex, I told everyone that I had swerved to miss someone and hit the, you know, it was always somebody else's fault. I forget what excuse I had for plowing into the showroom window, but, you know, it never occurred to me I had a problem with my drinking. I thought I was unhappy. It was my ex's fault. If I had the right guy, then I wouldn't drink. So my ex got this job working for Learjet in Tucson. They recruited a bunch of guys from England, and I didn't want to go. I thought if I stay home, maybe something will happen with this guy that I liked. And, you know, this was a perfect way that we could split up. Peter would go to Tucson, I'd stay home. But my mother taught me into going. She said, you love to travel, it's only for a year. You should go. What an experience. So I came. And it was absolutely wonderful. Most of these guys, some have wives, but there were a lot of single guys, they love to party. And we all had too much money. And I had too much time on my hands because I couldn't work because of the work permit my husband was on. And so we were partying every, and I mean really, partying every night. If we weren't at a club or a disco or a concert, then we were at somebody's apartment or around the pool, or and it was party, 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 and I loved it. I remember saying, well, when I get hangovers, I'll stop drinking. But when the hangover started, it was already too late. There was no way that I could quit. And I remember trying to quit one time. This is at the beginning of 1982. And I quit cold turkey. And I was a total basket case. I heard things. I saw things. I was jumping around. I felt like somebody was coming up behind me. I kept having these out-of-body experiences. It was awful. By the end of the third week, I was feeling pretty good. And I was still going out, but drinking club soda. Well, I had been drinking club soda, and one of our friends said, do you want to come back to our apartment to watch a movie? So we said, sure. So we get to his apartment, and he asked me if I wanted a drink, and I said yes. I don't remember anything else. I went into an instant blackout, didn't remember anything till I woke up in bed next morning, and thought, what the hell happened? And from then to my sobriety date, I tried to control it. I'd only drink on the weekends. But then it was always Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Or I would It would be Saturday, Sunday, and I'd have to drink Monday, and I'd have a couple of days in there where I didn't drink. But the misery of not drinking, the not sadness, just, you know, that horrible, horrible feelings. And it was like life just wasn't worth living if I couldn't drink. But I knew that I had to do, you know, I had to try and curtail it. But I didn't do a very good job of that. I mean, I just, it was one thing after another. I had a couple more wrecks, but not as bad as the last two that I'd had in England. I couldn't get any friends to go out with me anymore because I was such a liability. They needed to take care of me because I'd fall asleep, or I'd lose my purse, or I'd lose my car, or I'd lose my keys. It was always something, one thing after another. My ex was getting increasingly sick of this, but, you know, he kept putting up with it. And when the contract finished in Tucson, so much for the 1 year, by the way, that was done long ago. There was no way we were going home. You know, we liked the lifestyle, we liked the drinking, and I just couldn't imagine going back home. So we came back to San Antonio. We got a house here. We were here for a while, and then he got a contract in Oklahoma City. And so we go up to Oklahoma City, and I had started this new thing with my drinking where I would try and sober up on a Monday and I couldn't, and so I would take a drink and go back to bed, and I'd stay in bed for a week, 10 days, just getting up to go get a drink. If I could find my keys, if I could find my driver's license, because my ex kept hiding them. And so we go up to Oklahoma City, and we're there for nine weeks, I think. I pull one of my stunts, and these buddies he had said that I needed to go to AA. And what happened this night before I went to my very first meeting, I'd been on a bender, and I got up. I needed more booze, so I grabbed the checkbook. And I had been doing this. I would like go around the corner to the liquor store, and I'd hand them a check, and I'd just sign it and let them fill it in. And my ex had been around there several times saying, don't sell her any more liquor. She's an alcoholic. They didn't care about that. They just wanted the money. So I was in bare feet. It had been raining. I walked around there in bare feet. I picked up my bottle, handed in the check, and I'm shuffling like an old woman. I'm shuffling back to our apartment. He's outside with a bunch of his buddies fixing the car, and they saw me. And I'm like a deer caught in headlights. I'm trying to creep back in without them seeing me. And my ex goes, would you look at that? Would you just look at that? And oh, I felt horrible, but not horrible enough to stop drinking. I get inside, and he comes after me and grabs my bottle. And I get on my hands and knees and beg him to let, or on my knees, beg him to give me my bottle back. And so next morning when I got up, there was, I don't know how I made it through the night without any liquor. Maybe I had some hidden. But the next morning, I have this vague recollection that he said the yellow pages would be open on the coffee table. I better call somebody and go to a meeting. And so I called, and they told me about a meeting in this lady's house. And so I went. And I remember, I can see her as clear as day. She opened the door, and she was an older lady, probably younger than me. But she was an older lady, and this big old smile on her face, she asked me in. And there were 12 ladies there. And they all told a little bit of their story. And I thought, I found the answer. This is it. And I absolutely loved my first meeting. And I loved those people. And they took me under their wing. They took me to meetings. And for 3 weeks, I stayed sober. I didn't even think about drinking. But my husband, ex-husband, got a call that we were going back to Tucson for another contract. We arrived there in the evening. Next morning, I walked across the street, bought a bottle. And so I was off again. And that's how it was until January 1st, 1985. But That finished, we come back to, I think he went to Waco, and I said, I've had enough, I'm going back to San Antonio, I need to go to meetings, I need to have some kind of stability in my life instead of going all over the place on these contracts he was on. So I walked into Club 12 in September. June was in the office, and she told me about a beginner's meeting. That was September. I still had another 4 months to go. So I would be sober or dry for about a week, and I'd drink. I'd get 2 weeks, and I'd drink. But I kept coming back, and I love what y'all said. I wanted to be sober. I just couldn't get there. And but what happened was, we went up to Michigan at Christmas time to my ex's relatives, and I took a bottle with me. I've been sober for 5 weeks. We're at the airport, and I put my tote bag down, and it did that clunk sound, like only a bottle can do. And my ex looked at me and just shook his head. He didn't say anything. Didn't lecture me or anything. So we go up there. I need not a worry. They put us down in the basement with loads of booze. There was liquor, champagne, which I love champagne, liqueurs, everything. I was pretending to them that I wasn't drinking. And I would keep sneaking down to the basement. And who knows how many bottles I went through. But something had happened because I couldn't escape anymore. It was like I couldn't sleep. I had a stomachache. And I felt like I was dead. I just felt dead inside. So I knew I was going to come back to Club 12 when I got back here. So we're back the day before New Year's Eve. I'm home by myself again. After I sobered up, I realized my ex was gone a lot. And I can't say I blame him. Who would want to be home with me? But I was home by myself on New Year's Eve. George Michael was on stage on TV. And it was late, but it wasn't midnight. And I poured out the last of this bottle of Myers Platinum Rum. And I just felt like God tapped me on the shoulder and said, Carol, you don't have to do this anymore. I didn't realize what had happened because something miraculous happened then. I went to bed. I got up next morning, came to Club 12 like I planned. And back there in that old smokers meeting, very sacred ground it was back there. And I didn't realize what had happened until 2 weeks later. I thought, I haven't had a drink in 2 weeks, but I hadn't even thought about it. It hadn't crossed my mind. I'd been coming to meetings, I made new friends, and oh my God, New Year's Eve, it really happened. God touched me. God's taken away my desire to drink. And so, here it was. It had actually happened. So I was going to meetings all the time. I remember I had 2 months, around 2 months, and I'd been feeling this squirrely feeling. And it had gone on for a couple of days, and I go home. What I used to do, I would go to the 5:30, and then we'd go out and get something to eat, or we'd stay here and we'd talk. And I'd go home, and it probably around 7:30-ish, and I'd be okay. Sometimes, like I said, I would come back to the club and talk to somebody. But I went home that night, and I felt so squirrely. And I looked at the clock, and it said 10 till 9. I thought, oh, I could get to the liquor store. And then I thought, I don't want to drink. And I remembered that there'll come a time when no human power will keep you from that drink. That power has to come from God. I hit the floor and I said, God, please don't let me drink. Please don't let me drink. Please don't let me drink. When I got up, it was 9:10. Somehow 20 minutes had passed and I have no idea how. It was too late to go to the liquor store. That never happened again. And but there were plenty of times that I felt weird, uncomfortable, and like I said, I come back here and there. Usually it would be between while a meeting was going on. So I'd walk in and there'd be nobody here in the main room, but there'd always be somebody leaning up against the bar or just sat there, and it was always somebody strategically placed for me. And often that guy was Buck S. And this one time I got robbed and I was so mad, and I said, I need a drink. This was earlier on, like in the first month. And this voice came out of my mouth saying, no, you need to go back to Club 12. So I came back here. Bert is leaning up against the bar, and he said, "Hi, English, what's up with you? Why the long face?" I said, "I've been wrong. They took all my LPs, all gone. Coats, little bit of jewelry I had, they'd taken most of it." And I was so mad, and I told him this, and he said, "You didn't need any of that stuff anyway." And I said, "I did." He said, "No." He said, "Did you get hurt? Did they hurt you?" I said, "No." He said, "All that matters is that you're sober. All, none of that stuff matters. All that matters is you're sober." And I would hear his voice in my head every time something went wrong. "This really doesn't matter. As long as I'm sober, I'll be okay." And so I'm going to meetings, get a sponsor, May W. A few of you will remember that wonderful lady. And life is really good. And it was the Club 12 anniversary. So I had 8 months. And it's Friday night of the anniversary, and I am sitting back there with my sponsor, May. And this guy comes over to me and says, "Are you single?" May jumped up and got in his face and said, "No, she's not. She's married. Leave her alone." Well, that just empowered him even more. And so we became very good friends. Now, I'd like to say that I was already divorced from my ex, but I wasn't. And so Greg and I were friends for a while, and then it developed into more, of course. And May was furious with me. She said, "You have to put Greg on the back burner, and you've got to try and work on your relationship with Pete." And I said, "I can't." And I really thought I can't at the time. But long story short, we got divorced, and he had met a girl in the program just a couple months after we got divorced, and they got married. Greg and I weren't married yet, so we were let off the hook. And now we could, you know, everybody was okay with us being a couple because my ex had got married. And so we got married a year to that, the date of that Friday night, 1 year later. And George Brown was Greg's counselor. So he counseled us about marriage. And he was just great. And when we set the day, we told George, and we said, "Well, we set the day, it's going to be a year to when Carol and I first started talking." And George said, "Uh-uh, 2 years for you two." And we said, "What?" He said, "Just kidding." So we get married and set off on married life, and God was really good to us. Greg started, it was a very little business to start with, and it really, God blessed it. But a couple years into our marriage, I started this remorse and guilt about my ex. I felt so bad for the way I treated him. And so I kind of went into this, not a depression, I've never really been depressed, but I was really down about this. I couldn't believe that I'd done this. I was sober. How could I have acted like that? You know, and but I didn't tell my sponsor how I was feeling. So I started calling him and telling him how sorry I was. And, you know, I made my amends, and he said, "Well, Carol, I know, but I was no saint either." But I still didn't feel forgiven, I guess. I didn't feel forgiven. I felt guilty and remorseful. And so I called him a couple more times. I still didn't feel any better. And then Greg found the, why he looked at the phone bill, I don't know. But he said, "Who have you been calling in?" I think it was in Arizona. And so I lied. Anyhow, we ended up in counseling, one session counseling. And our assistant pastor said to me, after he heard the whole sordid story, "Carol, God deals with us where we are. And you aren't the same person you were back then." And I walked out of that counseling session a new person. I really did. And I finally had commitment you know, I've been committed to the program, but I'd never been committed to my marriage to my ex. I didn't know what it was until I came to AA, and you all taught me about commitment. And shortly after that, it may have been about the same time, I was in a meeting, and they were talking about making amends, and all of a sudden, the light went on. Up until this point, I had forgiven my dad, but that's as far as it was going. I thought, oh my God, it was me. It was my thinking. It was my perception. It was the way I behaved. It was what came out of my mouth. The problem was me. And I remember what May would say. In all my broken relationships, I was there. The problem was me. It had to be me. I was there. And so I knew I had to make amends to him. And Greg and I were planning a trip to go visit my family for the first time since I've been sobered up. So I knew I needed to go see him. And I got a message to him, and I remember walking up the path to his house, and my feet felt like lead. And I always tell this little bit because it's funny. I almost turned around and left, but Greg, who dropped me off, sped away in the car. And so I had to go through with it. And when Dad came to the door, I always saw my dad as a big man, like towering over me. Dad came to the door, and he had like a very grim face. And I'm like shaking. And I said, "Hello, Dad, can I come in?" And he let me in. And my dad is not very tall. My dad is, I think he was at the most then 5'8", but I'd always thought he was so huge. And I started making my amends, and I started crying. But as I cried, he just got all soft and squishy. And he said, "Carol, I did a lot of things wrong too." He said, "We won't talk about this again. This will be our new start." And so it was. So I come home. I spent about 3 hours with him, I think. And I'm sure in that time I spoke more to my dad than I had up until my parents got divorced when I was 19. And I thought it would feel really uncomfortable, but it didn't. And I came home, I thought, well, I'll write him a thank you note. So I wrote him a thank you note, and he wrote back. And then we would visit England like every other year. We're really blessed to be able to do that with the kids. I now had 3 kids. And we'd go see Dad. And over the years, God showed me, you know, how different my dad was than what I had thought. Yes, he was angry. Yes, he was controlling. And was he miserly? Yes. But I had judged him so harshly. And I didn't need that little girl relationship anymore. You know, I was grateful for what we had. And when I was on my 40th birthday, he called me. He started calling me on my birthday. And at the end of the conversation, I plucked up the courage to say, "I love you, Dad." I hadn't said that. And for the first time in my entire life, he said, "I love you too." And now anytime I talk to him on the phone, he always tells me he loves me. And I'm so great. He's 94. My mom's gone. My stepdad's gone. My stepmom's gone. My dad's still here. Isn't that interesting? That's the relationship that I have left. I'm going to really fast forward because I'm getting out of time. We had a daughter, Melody, and twin boys. She's 33, and our boys are 31. And my life was idyllic. It really was. We had a really idyllic life. Greg's business did well. I was able to stay home with the kids. That's amazing. I never wanted children until I came into the program. All of a sudden, I want kids. And I had 3. But when our daughter turned 12, she turned from this happy-go-lucky, precocious, wonderful, amazing girl into somebody we didn't recognize. It was like somebody flipped a switch, and that girl was gone. And she never came back. We see glimpses of her, but she became very dark and very unhappy and miserable. Then she started running away, and we were too involved in church at the time and not so much in AA, so never occurred to us to go to Al-Anon. And so, you know, we just kept trying to find a control. And she left home at 17, and things were okay for a while. But the long story short of it is, her life would get better for a while, and then it would crater. It would get better for a while, and then it would crater. And then in 2018, she was into drugs by now. I had no idea, or I was in such denial. She lost custody of our grandson. He was 10 at the time, and his dad, who'd been a total kind of waste of space, had got his life together, and so he stepped in and took Cecil, our grandson. And she ended up being homeless, and she still is today. I was crazy. You know, I was so wrapped up in trying to make this perfect family, trying to help her. I thought I could say something that would make a difference, that surely the shining example of whatever, you know. And she would listen sometimes, but it never would do any good. Anyhow, she ended up being homeless, and I did not see her for 9 months. Three ladies at separate times suggested I go to Al-Anon. And I had fought Al-Anon tooth and nail. I didn't want to go to Al-Anon. I didn't need Al-Anon. I had AA. I'm going to be fine. But after my sponsor suggested that, I knew I should go. So I went, and I intend to go for a few weeks, get my fix, tell me what to do with her, how to fix her, how I can make her well. And I remember it was at 3 weeks, and I heard a lady talk in that meeting about waiting. She'd been waiting and waiting and waiting for her husband to get sober. And I thought, my God, I've been waiting for, what was it, almost 20 years for Melody to get her life together. And, you know, I had lost all concept of one day at a time and living life on life's terms. I had lost that in this struggle to help her get right, to watch after my grandson, and also to make sure my two boys, who were grown, were happy. And so I'm driving home from this Al-Anon meeting, and these voices were in my head of what the different ladies had said, and I thought, I want my life back. I want effing life back. And I turned the corner that day, because the next day I called a lady I knew in the program who was a double winner, and asked her to be my sponsor, and I started working through the steps. The miracle that has happened to me in 2.5, nearly 3 years, is unbelievable. AA saved my life, but Al-Anon saved my sanity. And I can't tell my story without this little bit. I didn't see Melody for 9 months, and I think that was God's way of helping me get some healing before I saw her. She's homeless, but she's like within a mile and a half or 2 miles of us. She's been there all this time. I never saw her, she never saw me. And since that time, God has really, it sounds ridiculous, but blessed our relationship. I love her more than I ever did. When I see her, and I see her quite regularly, like once, twice a week, I take her some food and some toiletries. Don't give her any money. You know, she's not there. This is her journey. But she doesn't see disappointment on my face. She doesn't hear criticism in my voice. And that's a miracle. I love her just where she is. I'm not praying frantically, God, get her out of this. Please save her. Surely it's your will for her to get sober and straight. That's not my job. She's a grown woman, and she has her journey. And I don't know where that journey will go. And it's a scary thing sometimes, especially a woman being on the street. But I just have to trust God. And I'm going to say this one last thing that my sponsor said to me when I first went to Al-Anon. For some alcoholics, like me, who tried fixing everything in their family when I was about 11. And then I tried to fix, you know, my brother and sisters. I tried to fix things for them before I came to the States. It's like a pie. Our recovery is like a pie. And for me, an Al-Anon is like a slice of that pie. But for a lot of us, it goes really, really deep. And I had no idea till I started working the steps how deep it went. Because I thought it was just about Melody, but it was way, way back. And so I am so very grateful because I have the benefit of both programs. And I'm so grateful for y'all, or every one of you. And by the way, my home group is a freedom group, specifically the women's group. My homie is here. And and so thank you for allowing me to share my story. Thank you.
Carol, for sharing your story with us. Now we are at the end of our meeting and the closing statement. Remember who you see here, what you hear here. When you leave here, let it stay here. Here, here. Okay, let's close with the Lord's Prayer.